And hello, this is KPFK Radio, and this is The People's Game, a very special show because unlike all of our exclusively podcast shows, this is a live radio broadcast, and we are live in studio here in Los Angeles, California. I am Alan Minsky, and I'm here with
Jennifer Doyle of From a Left Wing,
Pablo Morales of Gringos at the Gate,
Fernando Romero of Gustavo Arellano's radio show.
And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk very briefly about what's been going on in the tournament. Then we're going to talk about Jennifer Doyle, our co-host here, who has an article, basically the equivalent of an American op-ed piece in today's Guardian of London related to the World Cup. Then we're going to be talking to George Asunge Fominyen. He is a lifelong Cameroon fan. He's a Cameroonian himself. About the first side that has actually been eliminated from this year's World Cup finals, which are Cameroon, having lost to Denmark 2-1. And then we're going to get another Cameroonian fan on, Liz Hoddle. She's based in D.C., but is a passionate Cameroon supporter and a blogger, and we'll be talking to her about her blog and her feelings about the results from today on the field. And then we're going to be talking to the filmmakers of a fantastic film that I believe we've all seen called Pelada. For those of you who are listening to on the podcast, as well as KPFK listeners live right now, that will be our featured premium as this radio station, KPFK, is in its fund drive. And I encourage those of you who are listening around the world in podcast also to donate to this radio station. More details, of course, about that later. So, team, again, we went through, I believe this is day
nine,
right, thank you, of the 2010 World Cup. And up until today, no teams had been eliminated, and I think it's fair to say that the big news coming out of day nine is the fact that Cameroon's been eliminated. But we'll be talking about that a heck of a lot. So maybe first off the bat, any thoughts on the other games that took place today? Holland, again, was rock solid, winning another match against Japan. And they are guaranteed of advancing. They're the first side to be guaranteed of advancing. And then a very dramatic match between Ghana and Australia. Australia can't seem to play right now without losing a man to a red card, but Ghana was unable to take full advantage and win the game.
Yeah, that's true. They're, unfortunately, because I was really hoping that Ghana would really show some real strength in this first round, but Australia just showed resilience, 10 men, and played it very well. I guess they had a lot of practice from the first game.
Yeah, I think I was rooting for Ghana as well. I was seeing this Ghana team to be the one African team to go really far, and right now it looks very difficult right now, but they still have one more game to play, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, what's interesting, too, is now they have a showdown with Germany, which is, of course, the Prince Boateng Michael Ballack bad
rematch.
Blood, right, where Ballack was injured by one of the premier players for Ghana, and basically they have the opportunity to eliminate the other side. I mean, mm-hmm. Germany is extremely vulnerable, and it is quite possible by the time of that match Ivory Coast will not – there's no way that Ivory Coast can have been eliminated by that point, but there's a very good chance that Ghana will really be the only African side with a chance to go through. Now, other sides may have qualified. Nigeria is still alive. Algeria is very much still alive, but they will have had to pull upsets, surprise comebacks within their group. Ivory Coast, of course, is in the group of death. So Ghana against Germany could be one of the really dramatic moments coming up, and that's in the Group D. And as for Australia, it was a heroic effort. And by the end of the game, I got to say, I thought they really got the better of Ghana.
They showed a lot more than they showed against Germany, that's for sure. You know, I think that team spirit that was shown in the 2006 World Cup, which wasn't showing against Germany, was very evident. And it was nice because I was a real downer on Australia after their game with Germany. But I think if they get a good win in their last game, they could do something.
And I also think it's fair to say, as we look to the other result, which we'll talk about in detail concerning Cameroon, is that Denmark has a very good chance against Japan of going through. And, of course, Holland has gone through as well. I mean, you're obviously a diehard Dutch fan. What did you think of today's performance?
Today's performance, they had their chances. I think they had a lot of possession of the ball. I think they dominated for most of the game, at least in the midfield. They didn't generate enough chances as to reflect all the possession that they had throughout the game. They only had maybe five or six. And the goal came off almost, I wouldn't say a freebie, but it was almost on you could call it a mistake on behalf of the Japanese goalkeeper.
Well, that was a rocket.
That was, I mean, it was Wesley Snyder, so you got to give him credit for, you know, he's one of the best long-range shooters in the global.
When you hit a ball that hard and the goalie's moving, I mean, it would have been a heck of a save.
Right.
Even though, you know, he did have it covered and then it went skewed off. Mm-hmm. It was a rocket of a shot. Now, the thing about Holland is how great will they be if Robin comes back?
I was actually thinking about the same thing because they basically are qualified mathematically. They still got one game left, and I'm wondering to see whether or not Robin will play in the third game. At least reports are that he is ready. It's going to come down whether or not they want him to play this, at least give him 45 minutes in the third game, or just rest him into the second round.
Well, I'd rest him. The guy's so damn injury prone. I would rather, if I was a coach,
I would give him at least some playing time, give him 45 minutes or something in the first half just to.
That guy gets out for months when he like stubs his toe taking the trash
out of him. I would want him to get him to some rhythm before the second round, at least just have him run around a little bit, kick the ball around.
I just love Ruud Gullit's comment after the game, which is the Dutch did just enough to win, and that's what you want to do in the first round.
Right.
You don't want to show your hand. You don't
want
to say, here's everything we have. And having Robin on the bench is a great ace up your sleeve. I mean, why show him now if you don't have to, I guess. That's my opinion.
I just wanted to go back a little bit to some of the games this morning just to point to one of my favorite blogs today, which was from this guy, Zach Dundas, who writes as Renegade Sportsman on True Slant. And he called the Australia-Germany group the group of stress. He said it's not a group. Setting aside, basically, he's like, the thing about Germany is however they're playing, nobody wants to meet them in a tournament. And then the other three teams, he says, they're not the lovable underdogs that everybody can get behind, nor are they teams with sort of storied football histories behind them. They're not romantic heroes. They're the teams that you don't want to meet at the other end of a dark alley. And I thought that was one of the best articles posted today about the games.
The Black Stars are in with an Africa storied side.
Yeah, he goes a little bit against the current and says they're actually one of the least lovable of the African sides.
Oh.
So I think there are a lot of listeners who might take point issue with that, but I do think it's a nice intervention actually.
For what it's worth, I mean, obviously Ghana will be pulling very hard for Australia against Serbia, as will Germany, I suppose, and because Australia's still, they're quite behind the eight ball. They're alive still. It was a heroic effort, but with the goals they gave up against Germany, they have quite a hill to climb to get out of that group. Big news around the People's Game today was that Jennifer Doyle had a comment piece, again, the equivalent of an op-ed piece in The Guardian of London today, and it was calling upon FIFA, in particular, in the context of this World Cup, to recognize sexual violence in the manner that they do racism. So, Jennifer, tell us in detail about it, and also the response you've gotten, which is quite large on the website.
Well, I mean, the inspiration for the article, as I've said before on this program, has come from conversations that I've had with John Turnbull from The Global Game and our response to stories that appeared about a year ago about the gang rape and murder of Yudi Simelane, who was a retired national team player, a midfielder for the South African national women's side. And her death actually became a flashpoint for organization and activism in South Africa to fight sexual violence against women in general, but homophobic violence against lesbians in particular. And lesbians have been singled out for not only rape, but violent assault, murder, at an alarming rate in a country in which all of the statistics regarding rape and sexual violence are truly alarming. So one of the things that has gotten to me as an athlete and also as a sports writer has been a gap in journalism on this issue. Insofar as this story gets reported in the context, of course, of things that are going on with women in the world, you know, of course, this is a big story in South Africa, but it's also a story in relationship to the World Cup. That this murder and the frequency of sexual violence and the threat of being a victim of homophobic assault is something that conditions the lives of all women footballers in South Africa in the most extraordinary and extreme ways that one might imagine. And so it has struck me as a real moral failing on the part of both the South African FA and FIFA, large scale as a global organization, in its resistance to thinking about adopting this particular issue alongside the World Cup as something that FIFA might become an agent of raising visibility, at least raising doing some consciousness raising, but more pointedly for me, and is the potential gesture that such a campaign might, the meaning of such a gesture for women athletes, for women living in South Africa in particular, but for women athletes around the world, to see Yudi Simelane and all that she gave to the sport. She was a coach, a referee, a league organizer. The sport was her life. To see that acknowledged and embraced and her legacy embraced in the context of the World Cup would be, I think, possibly a very powerful gesture towards women athletes around the globe. And it's almost utopian thinking on my part, and I acknowledge that. And a lot of the comments have actually been taking me to task for daring to kind of propose something so ludicrous as a feminist intervention within the space of the World Cup. And I understand that that's a fantasy, but I choose to live a life in which I prefer to imagine such things are possible, so in order to at least find ways towards making steps to create a world in which such a thing is no longer ridiculous. Yeah, so that's been that was the idea for it, and I'm really happy that they published the piece. So I just popped up today, and it's gotten maybe 30 something responses. And
but my sense is that people did engage it though in some depth who did write. They were hefty responses.
Yeah, the first was a woman. I think she's an African woman, and she was responding to I'm a white middle class feminist, so she was responding to my position, possibly participating within colonial narratives about Africa, reproducing negative mythologies around Africa. And she wrote back a couple minutes later to say that I was a little harsh because I'm writing this from Germany, and I'm surrounded by people who are saying the absolute most atrocious things that you could imagine about the World Cup being in Africa. And I was actually glad she made that point, because it was, I think, one of my own hesitancies to engage the topic in such a public way, is knowing that there are women in South Africa who are very directly invested with this issue and wishing that the British media in particular and the European media were in more direct and active conversation with those women and enabling them to actually take on this issue and be representing it. But in lieu of that, I figured somebody should write in and say something. And so that was me.
Yeah. I read the article. It was wonderful. And I really believe that the FIFA could, as such a large international organization that is, take on these kind of larger moral roles. But I think the listeners would be interested in some of the statistics you wrote about, because they definitely blew my mind.
Yeah. Mm. Now, I hate to start this with this kind of horrible phrase, but I'm not an expert, but right. So I come to this again, as a gender studies scholar who specializes largely in visual art, and then a blogger and enthusiast for the sport. But the statistics that I am aware of, it's that in essence, as many as one in two women will have experienced or been threatened with rape at some point during their life in South Africa. I've read in a couple different articles that women in South Africa are far more likely to be raped than to learn to read. That was the one that sent a chill down my spine. And then the other awful part of the story is, of course, as is often the case with victims of sexual abuse, is that the law has really failed victims of these attacks on every single level. And this is especially true for the women who are singled out for homophobic attack. Now, one of the things that I want to say, that the singling out of lesbians, and in particular butch lesbians, for sexual assault is not unique to South Africa. The story of Brandon Tina, who was upon whom the movie Boys Don't Cry was based, and she was actually raped twice and then murdered. That story, that happened in the Midwestern of the United States. So I just want to say that this is a global phenomenon.
Well, kind of going along the lines that Pablo was mentioning, I thought the piece was great. I think what I got from the blog was, what the blog piece was, that there's disregard for rape and sexual violence against women. And like Pablo mentioned, that FIFA is such a large international body that such a gesture in the World Cup would have covered miles and miles all around the world. I think I personally myself, I
right, and it goes back to the fact that absolutely, because it goes back to the fact that this is the biggest event in the world.
Exactly.
It is. I mean, American audiences, if you're listening to this in the United States, and most of you probably are, don't ever forget that about the World Cup. This is the biggest event in the world. Sorry
and
to interrupt.
I was going to add that, because I don't know if it's because it's the men's World Cup, where if it was the women's World Cup, it would have been different, but they could have done it anyway. I think that the issue is more prevalent than people think, because I personally myself, I used to volunteer at a rape crisis center about a year ago, and the stats that I would hear was like, even in the United States, was like one out of three women in the U.S. who would be sexually assaulted in their lifetime. And one of the things that we also talked about through that nonprofit that I worked with was the fact that that rape and sexual assault against women wasn't a women's issue. It was actually a men's issue because it was men who were...
That's the point I was trying to make on the blog. And I should say, if listeners get a chance to look at it, it's on the comment is free section of The Guardian. And you go down into the comment section. I have a number of links that will allow listeners to learn more about the issue and also to sign a petition, which is a request to FIFA that they actually honor Udi's memory publicly at the World Cup.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer. And the proper title of the article?
Football Stand Against Sexual Violence and Homophobia.
Homophobia, right. That's on theguardian.co.uk. Probably can just search for Jennifer Doyle, D-O-Y-L-E. Right now, though, we're going to move on with the show. Thank you so much for the conversation, all, and talk to George Asunge Fominyen. He is a lifelong Cameroonian fan. I spoke to him earlier in Senegal after Denmark eliminated Cameroon today in the World Cup by defeating them 2-1. This is The People's Game, and I'm Alan Minsky. I'm joined now by George Asunge Fominyen, who is a Cameroon national and a lifelong fan of the Indomitable Lions. Unfortunately, today, for George and other fans of Cameroon, they fell to Denmark, and that, combined with their previous loss to Japan, makes Cameroon the first side to be officially eliminated from the 2010 World Cup Finals. George Asunge Fominyen has a website where you can read all about the Cameroon national team. That website is georgefominyen.wordpress.com, and Fominyen is spelled F-O-M-I-N-Y-E-N. So, George, Cameroon played very well, had an easy time qualifying for the World Cup, but now just two games into the finals, and they're already eliminated. The team had a lot of promise. What went wrong for Cameroon in South Africa?
I would say that the problem with the team is a problem of management, is a problem of consistent organization of the players. And if you look at the results of the team this year only, you could have said you could see this coming. There were a number of issues tactically and technically that had to be fixed, and which were not done until this game. And when I'm talking about this game, I'm talking about the game against Denmark, when they were partially fixed, but I think it was a bit late to do that.
Do you think that potentially this, though, could have been a great team?
I think this could have been a great team. Contrary to the other teams in the past, it's a team which is made up of players that are playing in good teams in Europe. You have players playing in Tottenham, in the Premier League, players who won the French League this season. You've got Samuel Eto'o, who won three trophies this season, and so on. It's made up of players. You've got Alex Song, who plays for Arsenal, and things like that. It is actually considered by a lot of people as probably one of the best in terms of the individual potential of the players from Africa. Now, the whole problem is with the way the technical management of the team had to go on to put it together. So you have talented individuals, but they kept having problems playing together. And that's the key issue. They rather came into this competition thinking that they were going to perform as the team that did that performed in 1990, that took Cameroon to the quarterfinals, but then got stunned in the first game when they lost to Japan, and it got some infighting into the team, I would say, or things which they had under, they were trying to keep on the low came out with the players not in agreement with the coaches' selection and the coaches' tactics. And if you have 5 days to prepare a crucial game like they had to prepare against Denmark, and you spend time more settling squabbles between the coach and the players, you don't spend enough time for building the squad together to face that game. And so that to me, the whole thing is the managing the quality of players that were there. Le Guen did a very good job during the qualifiers. He realized by himself that the quality of players that he had during the qualifiers could not take the team very far, and so he had to rebuild. Now, the problem with rebuilding is if you rebuild, you have to be consistent with the choice of the new blood you're bringing into the team, and he wasn't consistent with that. He kept on changing, cutting and pasting. By the time he got to the World Cup, he wasn't quite clear of the standard team. The team that played against Denmark was close to standard, but it had a big, big yawning gap on its left flank, tactically speaking, which should have been noticed much more earlier if preparation was perfect.
I was very surprised to see that Alex Song was left out of the lineup against Japan. I very much think Alex Song is a great player when I see him with Arsenal.
Yes, I'll give two sides to Alex Song being left out. Now, there's a story about how there were difficulties within the team, within the camp, and so he wasn't picked. And then there is also the fact that what Le Guin was trying to put, Le Guin is a coach who is originally from France, Cameroon. What he was trying to put together, where he wanted, or what he wanted Alex Song to do, it seems Alex Song was a bit lacking to that. And I would say I even wrote blogs on that, the positioning problems he had with the team. I wouldn't have gone that far as leaving him off the field. I would have simply asked him to do what I want him to do and explain it clearly to him. But Le Guin went on the other side, and it wasn't quite a good idea. And today he was back. There was some stability, but there was also another player who wasn't doing completely what he was expected to do today. That was Eno, and Le Guin took him out, put somebody else who did not get the instructions right, and the same reasons that cost the goal, the first goal that the Danes scored, was the same reason that cost the second goal, which was the fact that the left wing, that the midfield wasn't shifting to cover the left wing of the left back position of Cameroon, which is played by Assue Kotter, which is the most offensive of the flanks.
Right.
He went forward, but never had anyone covering him, and every time what the opponent simply had to do was just to dig the ball behind him, and once that is done, Cameroon was caught in the counter.
Right.
And that has been consistent even through preparations for this competition, which means it should have been solved.
Right, and sadly, the Danish player Ramondahl on the right wing, so attacking Cameroon's left side of
yes.
their defense, is a very strong player and had a very strong day. We only have a minute left, and I suppose we'll just end on the sort of saddest note for Cameroonians, which is, I'll put it this way, what would have success for the Indomitable Lions meant, what would have meant to the people of Cameroon and Cameroons who live across the world?
Oh, it would have been a huge relief for most of the other problems they have. The national team is one thing that they think, that Cameroonians believe continues to work. And so when it fails, they kind of can reflect and see that everything else in the country, both politically and socially, is not at its best. For some people, losing is actually good because it makes people get back into real life, while for others, it is just winning is an opportunity to have some solace from the problems that they face. So you can imagine what it means for so many people. But what I would want to say is that one thing that Le Guin has done is that he has renewed the squad. What the authorities and the football authorities have to do now is to see how they build on what they have now as a team for the future. On that count, he didn't do a bad job.
Well, George Asunge Fominyan, thank you so much for joining us from Senegal, where it's very late at night now. Cameroon, unfortunately, is out of the tournament, but will you continue to watch the World Cup in the coming days?
I would. I'm a big football fan. I watch football all the time. I'm a Manchester United fan on normal occasion, so I still continue watching football. But I'm not quite sure which of the teams I'm going to be backing in a couple of days, in the next round of the competition. But who knows? I'll look at that.
Thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
Thanks so much, Alan.
And this is Alan Minsky. This is The People's Game, and I'm joined live in studio with
Pablo Morales,
Fernando Romero,
Jennifer Doyle.
And we're joined online right now by Liz Hoddle. She is the person behind the web blog, thegirlatthepub.blogspot.com, and she as well is a partisan of Cameroon. Liz, I'm sorry about the result today. How did you, how do you feel, first of all? We do want to sort of convey to listeners here how tragic losing one side from the tournament can be. But alas, how did you come to be a Cameroon fan as well?
I think my loyalty to Cameroon first began in the 1998 World Cup. I was actually in Italy at the time, and Cameroon and Italy were playing each other. So there was no kind of chance for me to possibly cheer for Cameroon, but I was really intrigued by their side and automatically kind of fell in love with their style of play and have been following them ever since.
Today's a sad day then.
It is. To be honest, I expected even less than we got today after the kind of nonsensical formation that appeared last week. So to see the team play, you know, the first 15 minutes was invigorating, and that was kind of, you know, true light, fluid football. And I was thrilled to see it, and I think the people I spoke to were thrilled to see it. So there is at least a sense that the team didn't embarrass themselves. They came out and, you know, fought for it as opposed to kind of, you know, being destroyed, obviously.
Yeah, it really was an extraordinary performance. I, by the way, I just want to say I love your tweets.
Oh, thank you.
She tweets as the girl at the pub, and I do recommend people who are following the Twitter feeds during the World Cup to check in with her, her insights, her sense of humor. But they did play really optimistically. It was an open game. I think the announcers must have used that word "open" on ESPN about 1,000 times.
No doubt.
Yeah, and one of your very sort of pointed tweets pointed out that if all of soccer was played this way, which is with in essence a minimal defending, at least it seemed like the. It was always attacking, and going back and forth, which is why they were all exhausted by about minute 50. It looked like nobody wanted to run anymore on both sides. But you said that the Americans would just take to the sport like ducks to water. You know, they would be totally, I get it now, right? But we don't actually often see a game like today. So it's just a shame that they lost. And it's just cruel that Cameroon is out and France and England are still alive. That
well,
is just
France is barely alive,
you know, but they haven't been eliminated.
Yeah.
and Cameroon actually they looked like something today, I thought, and they looked like they cared. Yeah. Which is more than I can say for those two other teams.
Well, the funny thing is usually that four of the groups had gone through A through D without a team being eliminated or a team guaranteeing their advancement. That's very rare.
Yeah.
Usually about half the groups end up with one team that's already gone through and a team that's out with 0 points. But the configurations hadn't added up to that, which means that the first games next week, people are going to be watching two screens. The world is going to be dizzy. But finally, sadly, with Cameroon and then good for Dutch fans, Holland's gone through in Group
yeah.
E. So finally, there won't be there'll just be one match to watch for the world. But there's a lot of talent on that side. There's a lot of flair. I mean, were you expecting a lot coming into the tournament, Liz?
I was, absolutely. I'm an enormous Alex Song fan. I'm an Arsenal supporter, and I felt like this was, you know, I mean, his development this season has been unbelievable to watch.
He's been great.
I thought that this was going to be his midfield to control, and I was, you know, so excited about that. And obviously, Asuokato and Bissong, you know, were really instrumental in getting Tottenham into the Champions League.
Yeah.
So I felt like, you know, that crop of players. And obviously, I mean, the maturity, I mean, Eto changed so much on Inter Milan this year and, you know, showed a kind of generosity as a player that we had never seen before. So I was convinced that those elements would combine to make a really great side. And I don't think that, you know, it was just a tactical mishap. I mean, obviously, you know, Le Guin was being influenced by just a bunch of different camps. And I think that one thing that does happen in Cameroonian football is just kind of grandfathering in of older players.
Mm.
That, you know, they get a kind of undue amount of influence within the football community. And then kind of put their foot in where it doesn't belong. I mean, you saw that obviously with Roger Milla. And, you know, Rigobert Song has made a great contribution to the Cameroonian team, but not for a long time. I mean, he's not playing competitively now. So the idea of kind of including him on the starting team I found kind of astonishing.
Mm-hmm. You, you're close to a group of Cameroon nationals and fans in Washington, D.C., what's your sense of what the defeat means to them?
I think that, you know, I mean, this is I think today is kind of, you know, the anticlimax. I mean, I think that really seeing Song benched, you know, Kamini benched last week. Yeah. I mean, I think that the side that was put out against Japan will go down as one of the most perverse starting lineups ever in the history of the World Cup. It didn't make any sense, and people were just kind of astonished. People here I spoke to, you know, kind of had their heads in their hands. They didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
So I think at that point, people gave up. And, you know, I mean, there was a high sense here that there had been governmental interference with the lineup. And, I mean, that's something that's endemic in Cameroonian football. I mean, Rajamila, you know, the head of Cameroon in 90 asked for Miller to be put on the starting lineup. He wasn't supposed to be.
Hmm.
And of course, you know, he did really well. And so that kind of set a precedent that interference could work for good, I guess. So people here, you know, I mean, I do think that the performance today buoyed people, and at least they felt like they got to see their team play. And I think that's really important. And I do think that the kind of crash and burn of this team, I think that people hope that this kind of terrible kind of early exit will cause a change in Cameroonian football in some way.
Yeah. I mean,
obviously the talent's there.
I think it's a sad fact of a lot of fans' relationships to their national sides is this struggle with the sense of the selection for the national team being deeply political or personality driven rather than talent driven. And, you know, for all the talk about sports being a level playing field and the like, when you really talk to serious fans, this may be one of the avenues of the most intense cynicism, right, is the management of the national side. And those of us who are in Southern California and have I've been following the Mexican team, that we know that this is a big
right.
part of the story of people's relationship to that national side too. France is another country where everything feels polluted by the mysterious forces of the French FA. So
as an Italian partisan, I mean,
yeah.
the core
yeah.
of this team is Juventus, which finished mm-hmm. what, 7th, 8th place in Serie A this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were the corrupt team a few years ago. And why he's picking players from Juventus.
Some important players didn't make it to the Italian team either. That
right.
were part
makes,
of the
makes people head spin. We got to let you go, Liz, in a second. Actually, we got a question from Pablo.
I just wanted to know. I mean, I know Pierre Webbo from Mallorca, and he never struck me as being a particularly great forward. If he puts in half his chances today, they win 4-2 running away. You know,
yeah.
is that, and since I don't see Cameroon that much, was that considered an unusual placement to have him up front with Eto'o?
Not really. Not as far as the placement. I mean, I think that the question was the finishing. And for me and for the people that I talked to, it was like there was no positional understanding at all. Because they've been moved in and out of their positions
yeah.
so often
yeah.
that they seem to lose any kind of spatial communication. And it was different than, you know, England, where the players seem unwilling to deviate from where they want to play. You know, they just weren't communicating on the field. They didn't know where that their teammates were. I don't think, you know, having him play up there wasn't that big a deal. It was just more of a sense they hadn't actually played in that formation in the World Cup before. I mean, it was a new thing.
Do you blame Le Guin?
Yes, she does. I can tell you that's a fact. Reading her Twitter feed.
I don't entirely. I think there are a lot of different forces at work. Absolutely.
Well, hey, we gotta let you go, Liz Hoddle, but one final, very quick question. Obviously, your team is out of the tournament. Will you continue to follow the 2010 World Cup?
I mean, I have no choice, of course. I mean, as long as I'm breathing, I will be following.
And do you have a side you'll root for, do you know?
Well,
it'll play out.
No, I don't know. I think that finally, after all of these years, I think that I'm a Team USA fan.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
There we
Yay.
Go.
Converted me at last.
Well, thank you so much again, Liz Hoddle, for joining us here on The People's Game, thegirlatthepub.blogspot.com, and apparently get on those Twitter feeds. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're going to shift right away to really our featured segment of today's show, which is a fantastic film that we are now going to talk to the filmmakers about. It is called Pallotta. All four of us have seen it. I think it's an amazing film. I think it is the film of the year when it comes to just global soccer. I mean, it really captures the spirit of the love and joy of the game of soccer. And we are joined right now on the phone by Luke and Gwendolyn, the filmmakers of Pallotta.
Hello.
Hey, this is Jennifer. It's really great to be speaking with you guys. I've had the pleasure of meeting Gwen Oxenham, but Luke, could you introduce yourself? You were a student. You guys were students at Duke, and then
Duke and Notre Dame. He's from Duke and Notre Dame. Right.
And so when you graduated, you decided you were going to make this film?
Gwendolyn, you could probably speak better to this than I could.
You can talk about your billboard job as well as I could.
Well, you did a lot of the grant writing.
we were at that age where all of a sudden the world feels smaller. We graduated from college, and, you know, you always think anything's possible, and then suddenly I was trying to write my book and failing miserably, and Luke had a job that, you know, wasn't his passion for life, selling billboards, and we played pickup every night, and it was our happiest moments, and we had a weekend where it was, you know, if we could do anything, what would we want to do? And Rebecca, who's behind the camera, we spent a night in the library trying to hash out and how we could figure out how to focus on pickup soccer, because it seemed like the most magical form of the game to us, yet one that has never really been focused on. And you hear so much about how universal the game is, and, you know, it unites everybody, and nowhere is that more true than on the pickup field, where you see 80-year-old guys and women in skirts and every sort of race, class, ethnicity, gender. It was a really powerful medium.
Yeah, this is the thing that really impressed me about the film, is that pickup soccer is such a local phenomenon, and it's actually quite hard to actually just stumble into a good pickup game. And your film actually tracks the two of you, though I understand it's a larger crew, moving all over the world and entering into what look like what must be one of the, you know, some of the best pickup games going in the neighborhoods and the cities that you're visiting. And so it's a great sort of peek into this very informal, ephemeral side of football cultures around the globe. So could you tell us perhaps one of the more extraordinary stories of the best or most intriguing pickup games that you discovered while you were traveling?
So one of the best ones is pretty relevant for right now. It was in South Africa. We went to Cape Town, and this was in 07, I want to say, maybe. Actually, no, it was probably 08, and they were working on the Greenpoint Stadium, and we said, you know, the people working on the stadium, they probably play some sort of game. And so we tried to do some research beforehand, couldn't find anything, but, like, got a contact at the stadium and went there. And it was around lunchtime, and they were like, well, it's lunchtime. This is when they go out and play their pickup game. And so we go out, and they've basically got, like, soccer-themed uniforms, and then they set down their hard hats and use those as goals, and they don't have much time. They eat everything, like, on their 15-minute break so that they can use their whole lunch break to play.
Wow.
And it was interesting. It was great to see, because, I mean, they're not working easy jobs. They're physical jobs. You'd think they'd want to take that to rest. But, you know, they were just so excited for the World Cup, so excited, you know, to play, and that was great to see.
That is the voice of Luke Bowen, and his partner in making Pallotta is Gwendolyn Oxenham, and they traveled around the world to find really just some of the great pickup soccer environments of the world, and they have made a film about it called Pallotta. I believe, if I remember correctly from having seen the film a few weeks ago, that Pallotta is a Brazilian term for pickup games. And Luke, by the way, was a starting midfielder and star for the Notre Dame varsity soccer side, and Gwendolyn was a star also for Duke. And what I can't quite remember is, were you midfielder? Were you offense, Gwendolyn, on Duke?
I played a bit of everything. I scored lots of goals as a freshman and played forward, but then the goal scoring ended, and I was more of an outside midfielder who who crossed the ball a lot.
Gwendolyn, can I ask you a question?
She dribbles to the corner.
Can I just ask Gwendolyn a question, which is that, I mean, most of the times, I mean, basically women, you can't find, like, pickup games that are only women, right? So as a female, a player entering a pickup game, you're usually one of a small group if not alone. So how was that actually entering into these pickup scenes as a female player? Was that an issue at all?
No, I mean, people look at me like I'm the crazy person at first.
Yeah.
Everyone's a bit shocked. No one says anything, but you can read it on their faces.
I get that all the time, even when I'm not playing soccer, so sorry.
But then as soon as I would, you know, pivot once or send one solid pass,
yeah,
everyone freaked out and totally loved it. And it was, and especially in South America, it was like, what? A woman love the same thing I love? And they were just so excited. I almost felt bad for Luke because, having a terrible game, but if I do one stupid move, everyone loved it. Well, Luke would score 6 goals. And they're like, oh, we know all about good guy players. Who cares about that?
Well, you're both remarkable players, and that is one thing that also is apparent from the film. But the reason they think Jennifer's crazy is because she's always carrying a soccer ball.
Yeah.
Wherever she is, she goes to lecture at UCR as a soccer ball.
You turn every conversation into a conversation about women's football, no matter what, even when we're talking about the Men's World Cup. Gwendolyn, I also just wanted to point out to listeners and so, you know, who may be interested in the film that she plays soccer with women in Iran, and that's
right.
Actually one of the most moving sections of the documentary is the delicacy of the relationships that you form with these women around playing soccer. Can you say just a quick bit about that part of the film?
Sure. Well, we tried to play in Iran, and it's illegal for a girl to play with men, technically, but there's this huge fissure between what the government believes and what the people do. And
yeah.
So I played with the men one day, and then we got reported to the government, and my playing days were over for Iran until the very last day after we met with the government. I had emailed a friend of a friend and got this contact for a woman who plays out there. And so we went to the court, and I got the chance to play with 4 or 5 Iranian women who were amazing at soccer. But like you say, it's rare to find a pickup game with just girls. So it was kind of my first experience. I've gotten much better at interacting with boys than I have with girls, and I felt very shy all of a sudden meeting a woman for the first time. But they were so wonderful, and you know, it's funny what you can bond over when you can't speak the same language, but they still they know David Beckham, and they oohed and aahed over David Beckham, and they talked. I found it fascinating because they talked about how they learned their moves through watching YouTube videos of Ronaldinho. So it's like even in Iran, this culture still carries over, and it was an incredible experience.
Like the Nike commercial.
Yes, that's what I was just thinking. Hey, you know what I found kind of interesting as a former college player was that, and I loved it in the beginning of the film when you guys talk about, well, maybe there's pros in our, you know, pro career in our future, and it doesn't happen, and you kind of think, well, what else am I going to do? And I mean, when I graduated college in the 80s, that was not even an option. It just kind of blew my mind. It suddenly made me realize why your passion might be even stronger, because there's these options now for good players.
Well, you know, the film we're talking about is Pallada, and we'll talk in just a few minutes about how it is available as a thank you gift when you pledge your support to KPFK Radio here in Los Angeles. But I want to focus on some other parts of the film that I just thought were, I mean, it's an unbelievable film.
Yeah.
And almost every sequence is utterly fantastic, and it's all over the globe, okay? Now, the Iranian sequence, of course, is incredibly memorable. The South African one, of course, extremely poignant for the circumstance now. But along with those, the segment in Kenya, in the poor section of Nairobi is just unbelievable. And
I think the Israeli one right now it would have been very interesting for people to see when everyone brings up Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the interactions between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
That's
was intense.
Intense. Yes.
It's worth watching there if you have an interest in that topic.
The story I'm desperate to hear is, how did you guys get into a Bolivian prison?
Unbelievable.
And play a game there. How on earth did that happen?
Let me just say, because I was about to bring that up too, because that is just astonishing. I mean, this is the most incredible, I think, sociological footage. maybe I'm just drawn in easy because I'm a soccer fan, but I think all of the countries and cultures that we just described, I've seen nothing like it this year.
Hmm. Gwenny, are you deferring to me on this one?
Yeah, you're the Spanish speaker.
Yeah, I guess I did the negotiations.
How did you hear about this game?
It is weird because the prisoners run the inside, so there's no guards on the inside. So we had to basically get the okay from the guards on the outside that we were going to go in, and so that was basically it from them. I mean, we didn't have to really deal with them, but then once we got inside, we did have to give a little bribe to the prisoners, that run the place, to make sure we were all right. But then once you're on the field, I mean, there's nothing about that, and it was just playing some of the best soccer we had played, because,
yeah,
you know, those people in there have more time than the people on the outside. I mean, they play every day, all day. That field is, that court squeezed between the rows of prison cells is, you know, all day.
It looked like it was about the size of a basketball court. I mean, it was a very fast.
Or smaller, actually.
Yeah, it was very fast.
It was a great game.
Yeah.
It was a great game.
Yeah, it was also like, you know, sort of the Fenway Park of soccer fields. It was all weird angles and, you know, acute little niches. And you guys played.
You had to have a halftime and switch sides because it was not equal.
In terms of, like, the gender and issues around pickup soccer matches, that had to be one of the most intense things as well for Gwendolyn.
I don't know. Her skills just look like they speak for themselves.
Yeah, but she might have been. Do you think you were the only woman to ever have played on that pitch before?
Wow, crazy. I guess I've never thought of it in that sense. People always make a big deal out of being a girl. But for me, I've grown up playing pickup constantly, and it's the last thing on my mind while I'm playing. And maybe the prison was the one place where I was a little bit more aware of being a female.
Right.
I was really just nervous because it was really, really good soccer, and I always want so badly to make sure I'm not like a girl who sucks it up, and I did fine, but it was a really intense game. And what was crazy is that apparently back in how we heard about the prison in the first place is because back in the 80s, we read in Lonely Planet that backpackers used to bribe their way in for drugs. So it occurred to us we could bribe our way in
for soccer.
No, and it is intense to watch you out there because, of course, it is this thing where, you know, you see all the men who are, and a woman walks out to play, and of course, it's like the first drop of the ball, and you establish yourself as this incredible player, Gwendolyn. So there's always that drama in the sequences, but in the prison, I mean, you play brilliantly. I remember that sequence very well.
I think a lot of people think during World Cup month that soccer's a drug as well. For those of us waking up so early.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that's like one of the quotes from the people in the prison. They were saying, you know, it helps you to keep from thinking about drugs, thinking from running away. Mm. You know, it's all we have to pass the time, basically.
Before Fernando asks his question, I got to do this. My duty here as a staff employee and interim program director at KPFK. Call right now at 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK, and we have a limited number of copies of Pallotta available. We're asking that you give a set at the $75 level to KPFK, and we will send you, as a thank you gift, a copy of this brilliant film, Pallotta. It's about two great soccer players who go out and participate in pickup games all over the world. It's an amazing film. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. It's just a $75 pledge of support to this public community radio station. We shall send you a copy of Pallotta, 818-985-5735. For $125, we have a 4-CD World Cup music pack you can get as well. Mm. Get it all together, the DVD plus the music pack, for a $200 pledge of support to KPFK. Please call right now, 818-985-5735. And Fernando, I believe, has the next question.
Well, I was just I wanted to ask Luke or Gwendolyn, whichever wants to field this question. I was watching the movie. One thing that kept coming up on my mind as if you're a connoisseur of global soccer, and you know how we all think that the English play this way and the Germans play this way, and you going to this really tough neighborhoods throughout the world and playing soccer with these men and women. My question is for you: did the things that we think about, you know, the Germans, are they as cynical as we think they are when they play pickup, or can you describe what can you just give me what that felt like, what you thought about that?
This question used to give us a lot of problems, but I think we've kind of come to a certain feeling on it. The Germans kind of were like that, first of all, yes. And they were, you know, technically good passers, blah, blah, blah. And the Brazilians are, you know, they love the game. But other than a couple, like, stereotypes, it was really more dictated by the crazy surfaces. Like, each kind of place would have a different field. And so, like, in Kenya, where they had cleared off a dump and it was just this tough, rolling dirt field, you know, that made a certain type of game. And there were certain, or in the sand. Or, Gwenny, do you have anything?
Yeah, well, just speaking to that, I mean, in Kenya, the field Luke's talking about, it was actually a garbage dump that they converted into a field, but the trash still kind of rises out of the ground no matter how often they clear it. And so, I mean, I think that influences the type of soccer you end up playing, because it was very much based on reaction time and athleticism, and, you know, there was no option of dribbling or passing because the field was so bad, and you wonder how surfaces and conditions then infuse your national team game. But I think Germany and Brazil fit most clearly into this typical stereotype. But everywhere else, I'm not sure you could say that.
Okay, we got about 2 minutes, 3 minutes max left. Go for it, Pablo.
Well, first, I just want to reinforce everyone out there that this is an amazing movie and well worth $75. And I just, you know, there's the stereotype of that soccer in the world is a working class sport.
Yeah.
And most of the places you went were definitely would be considered below level of poverty in the United States. And you both seem to come from relatively upper middle class U.S., which is how the world sees the U.S. soccer players' backgrounds. How is that? I mean, in as simple terms as you can, you know, state.
How's suburban soccer?
Well, I mean, how much? What was the kind of conflict you ran into that you weren't? I mean, you were probably pretty prepared for it, but was there anything that really stuck out? I mean, is soccer everywhere? It doesn't matter.
In other words, did any kind of class difference that boundary was swept away too just by the sport?
I know as filmmakers, we were very conscious of not wanting to seem like rich white kids going slumming. You know, there is that very ooey feeling of when rich Americans go do something, and Luke and I, you know, are not rich and have been homeless for some time now, but
post college homeless,
right? Yeah, but compared to the rest of the world,
you've put it to great use.
Yeah, I wanted to say pickup soccer is one of those. This is true of pickup basketball as well. That. While it's not always the greatest of mixers in terms of cross-class contact, it is a space in which people can appear, and you're not necessarily marked right by your class position. You're marked more by your skill, you know. So class does actually, I think, it can be invisible within pickup, which is one of, I think, the things that people really treasure about it most on some level, that you kind of get free from your social position.
And hold on one second, Luke and Gwendolyn. I have to be an ogre here and pitch just this stuff one more time here for a couple minutes here. The number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. For a $75 pledge of support, you can pick up the film Pelada. When you pledge your support to KPFK, we send it to you as a thank you gift. Again, 818-985-5735. We have a limited number of copies of these available. Please call right now. It is an astonishing film. 818-985-5735.
Yeah, and I want to say that one of the things that I really found moving about the film is that while you represent the kind of universal pleasure of playing, you don't level the differences between the different places in which you play. So I want to make that clear to listeners, because I think a lot of the films that and the mass media things that you're seeing around the World Cup have this kind of universalizing, abstract way of representing soccer. And here in this film, you get a real close to the ground and sensitive portrait of very local scenes, and an awareness from the filmmakers too that this is just a glimpse, right? You're not making some kind of total, absolute, you know, unifying equation that represents the totality of global soccer. You're not even trying to do that. You're talking about something that's much more individual and local, and that's what made it a moving and beautiful film to me.
And speaking on that for just a moment, it was kind of shocking because, we didn't really go, you know, everywhere in the world, because we wanted to. I mean, there's probably a story everywhere in the world, but we just went to a limited number of countries just because we had limited amount of money. And it was kind of shocking that in each place we found a story, and that was kind of one of the biggest shocks, was that, like, it really was everywhere. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Again, I have to be the ogre here and say 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, $75 pledge of support and pick up. People are calling in. The lines were full. Now they're open again. There's a few lines open. 818-985-5735 is $75 pledge of support for this amazing film, Pallotta. $200, and you get the film plus the World Cup soccer pack. And I just, before I let you go, Luke and Gwendolyn, I have one question, maybe two words from each of you. Luke and Gwendolyn, what team are you rooting for, and what team do you think will win?
USA.
USA on both, right?
I do have them in the final in one of my brackets.
All right. And Gwendolyn?
Yeah, of course, USA, but I'm also, I love Ivory Coast, and as for winning it all, I would say Brazil, if it's not the USA.
Okay, and thank you so much again, Gwendolyn Oxenham and Luke Bowen, the directors and stars of Pallotta, an absolutely fantastic film. Mm-hmm. And I want to just pitch this really hard for the next 30 seconds here, folks. Please call in. You will not get anything that is more joyous and more sociologically insightful about the cultures of the globe than this film, Pallotta. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. It is a $75 pledge to this station. We will send it to you as a thank you gift. For $125, we have a 4-CD pack of World Cup music, music inspired by the 2010 World Cup. And $200, get the DVD plus the 4 CDs. This is The Global Game. I am co-host Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
I'm Fernando Romero.
And Pablo Morales.
Thank you for joining us today, and please keep those phone calls coming again. $75 for a featured thank you gift this hour, the fantastic brand-new film, Pallotta, on DVD. Thank you so much, Tamika, for helping out in Master Control.